someone else's journey is our lesson.
We used to say, the difficult we do immediately, the impossible just takes a little more time.
Someone else's lesson is our gift.
I believe part of our responsibility is really to equip and inspire our students to ask those difficult questions.
Be encouraged by the stories that lift us all.
I came to Howard because I wanted to be the President of the United States.
Somebody saw something in me, and it's my duty to be that person for somebody else.
Now, join Dr. Wayne Frederick, President of Howard University, and his guest on The Journey.
He can move a project from an idea to a reality. As a program manager, he's responsible for the planning, design, and construction of many educational facilities from public and charter schools to higher education and beyond. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick, and my guest today on The Journey is the Howard University Executive Director of Campus Planning, Architecture and Development, Derek Neese-Williams. Welcome.
Thank you, sir.
So first, let's start with your own background. Tell me a little bit about how you grew up and what were your early influences?
Well, interesting that you should ask. I have kind of a unique upbringing. Both of my folks were diplomats, so they worked for the Foreign Service. My mother in agriculture and natural resource management. My father worked for the intelligence service. And so that actually exposed me to a multitude of different environments, traveling from country to country, very similar to sort of a military family. However, the sorts of posts that we were located at were a little different. So it sort of exposed me to life here in the continental United States, as well as life in West Africa and in the West Indies. So I had, you know, a lot of different travel, and not just, you know, a few weeks here, a few weeks there, a month here, a month there, like many people, you know, get exposed to that sort of environment, but actually full time, you know, living in those sorts of host nations.
So mention a few of the specific nations and what you took away from probably a couple of those experiences.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you should ask that. You know, a couple of the nations I live in, just to give you a few examples, would be Dakar, which is the capital of Senegal. I was actually conceived and then later came to live in Bamako in Mali, as well as in Bridgetown in Barbados, just to give a few examples. And the interesting thing that sort of revealed to me prior to actually living full-time in the United States as a citizen, it really was the fact that color is something that, while in this country, is very present and sort of causes people to group together into clusters. What it exposed me to overseas is that really, you know, living in majority black nations and then coming here to the United States, to Detroit, in fact, and seeing those divisions between people, they're present everywhere. It doesn't necessarily matter what someone looks like. You know, a lot of it is afforded in the mind, so to speak. And so, you know, interestingly, when I came to Howard, that was one of the things that actually drew me here to this institution, was that, there was sort of a majority sort of black environment here. And so I didn't necessarily feel like the odd man out, so to speak. But also that I was able to identify and find people that had similar psyches, that had similar perspectives on the world that transcended race and everything else. And so it was interesting to be in an environment where you're not just hanging out with people and connecting with people because they happen to be in the Black Student Association, for example, which is what many of my peers at other institutions have sort of expressed, but really finding people that align with exactly what it is that you're thinking, where your mind is, and, you know, how you plan on developing in the future.
Now, why architecture? What led you to the field of architecture?
So when I was 13, I actually came to live in the United States full time, and it's because the nation we were living in, Senegal at the time, didn't have a fully accredited American high school. So my parents chose to send me to boarding school, to a school called Cranbrook Kingswood, just outside of Detroit. My mother's family is actually from the Flint area, so that, you know, was a little close to home. They're tolerable for them. And that entire institution was actually designed by one architect, a guy named Elio Saarinen, who was a Finnish architect. And he actually resided there at the school, taught in the graduate art program, and also really designed the entire environment, raised his family there. And so the idea of this one man sort of creating this massive environment that not only, you know, he benefited from directly, and that his son benefited from growing up to be actually one of the more influential modern architects of our era. But it was just very cool to me, the fact that this guy, you know, in his mind, was able to design and create this entire educational environment that has served generation upon generation of people and really helped people to become, you know, better at what they do and find their way in this world.
So I mean, clearly an early influence that you were able to take, you know, further into your college career. There are only 178,000 architects in the U.S., and 4.1% of them are black.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the environment currently professionally in terms of when you engage and interact with your colleagues, mm-hmm. and what is being done, if anything, about trying to get more people of color into these fields.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that I personally feel that Howard University has made a big difference in that, just in general. So there was a time in this profession, and it has been referred to, you know, and it was actually referred to me when I was a freshman as the white man's profession. So the statistic that you shared isn't shocking. I think that probably 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, that number may have been even half that. And so I would say that in general, interest is something that's an important thing. And what I experienced at Howard's architecture program, you know, I think we came in with about 50 students overall in an incoming class. And by the end of the first semester, almost half of those students had transferred into other majors. Some of that has to do with, you know, folks thinking that architecture is one thing and then realizing that it's another when they actually get to school. But the other side of it really has to do with the rigor. The fact that you have to blend so many different sort of levels of understanding. You know, architecture reacts to human beings. We're creating a habitat for human beings to reside in and, you know, conduct their affairs in. And understanding that makes you really have to study the human systems and, you know exactly, you know, the sociological factors, the social engineering factors, all those different factors that contribute to a layout of a space, such that form can follow function and function can follow form. So, you know, that's something that I feel like Howard specifically is, you know, very well suited to prepare students for, especially designing spaces to serve a particular demographic. You know, as to what's being done in the industry at large, you know, I feel like the District of Columbia is somewhat insulated from some of those statistics that you shared, just being, you know, majority black city. So for the most part, what I experience here, and part of why I've stayed here in Washington, D.C., home of Howard University, is because, you know, when I'm at the table in this city and we're dealing with architects and engineers and developers, it's a high probability that many of the people around that table will look exactly like you and me.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Mr. Derek Neese Williams. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. To switch gears a little bit, tell our listeners a bit about what is a campus master plan.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Well, as the name would suggest, it is the master plan for an entire campus or series of campuses. Technically, it's a document that all universities in the district are required to file with the local government. Because universities own such large amounts of land, you know, relative to a single landowner or even a large developer, the district is very interested in knowing exactly what universities plan to do over a span of years. So it's a statutory requirement that every university have master plans on file with the district that are compliant with certain zoning regulations and land use changes and whatnot in the city. So it's something that is not internal to the university. While it does, you know, govern university business, so to speak, it is something that is an engaging process. It's a process that involves community members, it involves council members, constituents, alumni groups, the list goes on. So it's reflective of the whole institution as well as our neighboring community and all of the district agencies that, you know, we have to interact with on a daily basis.
And the current master plan has been in place for how long?
It's been in place since 2011.
And will carry on for how many years?
Well, it is a 15-year plan. So that is actually 5 years longer than the average statutory requirement in the district.
So that engagement of the community sounds key in mm-hmm. terms of getting that, as well as obviously looking at the future of the institution in terms of strategic planning and where the institution is heading.
Mm-hmm.
So with that backdrop, tell me a little bit about the key components of the plan that have been fulfilled thus far
mm-hmm.
and what that process has been like to this point.
Absolutely. So the plan is actually broken down into three phases. The first phase of the plan is nearing substantial completion. So many of the facilities that were sort of dictated to go into that first phase are already finished. A couple of them are related to student life. So we built two new residence halls totaling upwards of $100 million on the 4th Street corridor, and we infilled in between two existing underclassmen residence halls to create a zone of our campus that's cloistered from any sort of external influences and is directly adjacent to the core academic heart of the institution. So that gives us the capacity to house the prevalent majority of most of our freshmen and sophomore students in an environment that really predisposes them towards academic success, given the proximity to the core academic functions that they need. In addition to that, there is an interdisciplinary research building that is located on Georgia Avenue that sought to sort of bring myriad disciplines together into one facility under one roof so that innovation could really take place and take foot in that building. To date, I guess prior to the construction of that building, the research enterprise was kind of spread out in a number of different places, and it led to certain missed opportunities between researchers that otherwise would have or could have collaborated together on certain projects to make the world better. So those three projects have been implemented in lockstep with the master plan. Interestingly enough, the plan did call for two new research buildings, but they were to be purpose-built, so very specific research functions to be housed in each of them. And, you know, as trends would be, I think the university did itself a solid to have the foresight to build something that really spoke to interdisciplinarity. The only remaining project from the master plan that remains unbuilt is a recreation and wellness center. So once again, you know, sort of picking up the strings of creating student life, creating and improving campus life and amenities. I think that wellness and fitness are important aspects to any sort of young aspiring professional's life. And to the extent that the university can construct that function here and enhance that programming and integrate it with our health sciences complex and our health science function, I think that it will do our alumni a service, our faculty a service, and the local community a service. So we're really looking forward to completing that first phase of the master plan and then charging forward into future phases.
What are the primary elements of the second phase?
The second phase actually has a number of new student housing assets going up as well, more so focused on graduate students and upperclassmen, so your juniors and your seniors. And so that's actually to be slated for an environment that is on the west side of Georgia Avenue, closer to U Street, closer to nightlife, and, you know, sort of, you know, exposing students to a broader range of offerings that the city has, as opposed to keeping them in the cloistered environment that I mentioned before for the younger, more academically vulnerable students. In addition to that, there is an expansion to the Blackburn University Center to add more student amenity space and activity space for student organizations, clubs, meeting space, et cetera. And a few, you know, sort of infill projects with respect to renovations of existing buildings for academics. So there are a number of other things in that plan in those phases. But, you know, given the changing nature of our administration, as well as the changing nature of student body, the faculty, and the community around us, I think that it does bear some reexamination, which the current administration has been going through, as you know.
Now, the campus master plan obviously is kind of the roadmap, and to the point you just made, there has to be flexibility in terms of the changes that must take place, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The surrounding environment is changing more rapidly than, you know, we can probably adjust the campus master plan to very quickly. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the biggest challenges, and how do we meet those challenges around the changing environment?
Well, one of the key things is that this changing environment has actually placed very strong, very favorable market forces right here at our doorstep on the university's main campus here, the central campus. So the value is definitely there in this neighborhood. And as we all know, real estate is cyclical. So the value is here today, but as the cycle goes, 5, 10 years from now, maybe even 1 year from now, the value may not be there. So part of the strategy with respect to our master plan, which does need to be an organic, living, breathing document that changes and adapts in lockstep, is, you know, basically taking that into consideration. That's something that the existing master plan actually does not contemplate heavily at all. The prospect of commercial use to begin to generate additional revenue so that the university can continue to support its mission in the fashion that it has been through, you know, relative affordability and, you know, high quality education. So I think that those are the main aspects there.
Thanks for being here. My guest today has been Mr. Derek Neese-Williams, the Executive Director of Campus Planning, Architecture and Development. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne Frederick on the Howard University Radio Network.